You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And the so many circuses continuing. The Herman Cain circus, of course, going into the meltdown phase. He's supposed to have a press conference at some point today, but I think he pretty much said it last night on Jimmy Kimmel's show, I think it was, that, clip number five. I'll let Herman Cain speak for himself.
We had a little surprise to show up on TV. Yeah. We watched it because we didn't even know that this whole thing about woman number four was going to even come out. Mm-hmm. So that was a surprise.
Yeah.
And at least it wasn't one of the many that have the first name anonymous. So there's not an ounce of truth in all of these accusations, and my team is putting this stuff together. That's why I'm willing to do a press conference tomorrow to set the record straight.
Yeah. So... I mean, this is a guy running for president of the United States, which is probably the most scrutinized job in the world. You know, Bill Clinton was having all these bimbo eruptions, and now it's Herman Cain, and it's you know, Clinton seemed to survive it until he became president. And I think that a lot of Republicans are looking at this going, uh-oh. And in fact, the president of the Conservative Women of America came out this morning and said, "We're not so hot about Herman Cain anymore." Yesterday, I had a long conversation last night on our TV show. I had a long conversation with Morris Berman. In fact, we turned it into one of our conversations with great minds. It'll be up a little later in the day on the website for that. And Morris Berman has a new book out. He's the third in a trilogy, and the essence of all three of these books is basically that the United States is an empire, its time is over, and it's croaking. And if you look at the various countries of the world that have been empire, there are some really substantial similarities. And what you find is that when people are standing up and pointing it out or try to fight back, they get ridiculed by the beneficiaries of empire and by the boosters for empire. And by empire, I'm talking about a political and economic system, and they are very much tied together. A political and economic system where there's basically three components to it. One is perpetual war. Empire is all about war, ongoing war, continuous war. And you think of all the countries that we've invaded in the last, 30, 40 years. I mean, it's just you can see this is, or the last, 200 years, I mean, 100 years anyway. This is one of the hallmarks of empire. An extension. Basically, it's like the country constantly is reaching out, both to provide employment for its young men in particular, but also to acquire assets and resources. Whether it was the Spaniards, the Spanish Empire, going into South and Central America looking for gold, or whether it was the Roman Empire 2,000 years ago, after they deforested Rome, spreading out and going up into and through Europe looking for wood. It was an empire that almost crashed because it ran out of energy. When it became so expensive, when wood became so rare in Italy that they could no longer smelt their coins for less than the value of the coins because of the cost of the wood, that was the point at which they chose to expand. It was a couple hundred years B.C., and so by, 50 AD or so, there they are in England. And you can, this is the history that Jefferson wrote about in his many letters and in his journals and whatnot. When he sent his books to the University of Virginia libraries, Tacitus is the one you had to read. Tacitus was the nephew of Agricola, the Roman emperor and leader, and he And he chronicled the wars of Rome against the original British people, the tribal British people, back around the time of Christ. And, you know, that empire, so number one, war, and number two and three, bread and circus. Keep people fed, keep them entertained, and give them a war to participate in, and you can maintain your empire. The problem is, whether you look at, and look at the various countries that have been empires within recent memory. I don't mean our personal recent memory, but, you know, that are close enough, near enough in. I mean, we don't pretty much study the Sumerian Empire or the Egyptian Empire or even the Mayan Empire. But the European empires of the last few hundred years, France, Germany, the UK, Sweden, Norway, Spain, Rome, Greece. Greece goes back a couple thousand years. Rome goes back, you know, Greece is 3,000, Rome is 2,000. But these empires are fairly well studied by American students. And what you see is that they reach a point where they basically fall over. And as they fall over, they go through some sort of a transformation. Either they get wiped out and vanish, or they become just, hey, it's just us, it's just our country. And I would submit to you that that was the subtext of Ross Perot's argument back in the election of 92. You know, don't get into GATT, don't get into the WTO. You know, let's go back to a protectionist America. You get 20% of the vote. You had Admiral Stockwell on there going, well, you know, I don't think that we should be an empire all over the world. An empire is basically a bubble. It never survives. It's a cancer. It eats its host. And it depends on these three things, on bread, circus, and war. And frankly, there are signs of the collapse of empire that we are very much seeing right now. I mean, we have wildly exceeded our ability to sustain our presence all around the world. You have at home people saying, no, wait a minute, stop. Whether it's the Tea Party movement or the Occupy Wall Street movement, as I've said many times, the Tea Party movement, obviously, you know, there was this AstroTurf element to it. But what it did is it brought out people who, at, you know, many of them relatively politically unsophisticated, or they've been watching GOP TV for too many years. You know, they call it Fox News, but when Roger Ailes suggested it to Richard Nixon back in 72, it was called GOP TV. They've been watching GOP TV for too many years, and they have this kind of deformed, twisted worldview. And the Occupy Wall Street folks, I think, you know, a fair number of them actually get it. And they're saying, this can't be sustained. So what do we do? How do we back out of this? Well, you stop your wars internationally. You stop war as being an instrument of the acquisition of goods. Right now, we're using it to acquire oil, our energy supply. We're doing like Rome did with wood 2,000 years ago. You become self-sufficient, which we've been close to at times. We've been at times. We must become again. I think it was interesting, day before yesterday, Paul Krugman had a brilliant piece in the New York Times about how the price of solar is now basically to the point where it competes with anything. And if you were to actually take the costs associated with burning coal or oil that you and I pay for as taxpayers rather than the oil or coal companies, and added those on to the cost of oil and coal, solar's actually cheaper right now. So that's another step. I'll give you a few more right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And also, how does Occupy Wall Street stop its renegades? Or should they? So you have the super wealthy in America, the advocates of empire, the beneficiaries of empire, you know, lashing out. Rush Limbaugh, for example, here's this is clip number 9, talking about what's going on in Ohio.
Public and private polling indicates that Ohioans, by a substantial margin, want to overturn the new law, which means, if this is true, that people in Ohio want to rape themselves.
Right, right. You know, if you're paid enough money, you don't have to make sense. And Steve King, Congressman Steve King, going on about this. Dick Morris, actually. Well, I've got a bunch of these that I'll share with you as we go on. But the bottom line here is America, over the last 30 years since Reaganomics was imposed on us, and you know, it really hasn't changed. And since Ronald Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman antitrust laws, and so companies started getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, and then more and more and more transnational. And this is one of the main ways that Mitt Romney made his money, was setting up shell companies in the Cayman Islands to shelter income tax, to avoid income tax here in the United States. That these are all signs of this corruption. You know, the government has become corrupt. And the institution of government that should prevent corruption, the Supreme Court, has become the corrupter. And in the midst of this, you have people standing up going, no, this is wrong. Enough already. It's time to stop. And for a while, it was the Tea Party, and now it's Occupy Wall Street. And the Tea Party, you know, they had their renegades. They had their crazies. You had some militia folks. You had people who showed up with guns. They had the whole gun demonstration here near D.C. and whatnot, you know, standing on the other side of the river where it was legal. Let's do the open carry thing. And people running around with, you know, signs with Hitler mustaches on Obama. And on the Occupy Wall Street movement, you have your renegades, as it were. You have people who are, for example, with the Koch brothers a couple days ago. We talked about this yesterday on the program. We had Adele Stan on, who is a reporter for Alternet, a progressive. And she was trapped inside the building with the Koch brothers and couldn't get out because this human chain wasn't even a human chain. I mean, they had, you know, holding their bodies up against the doors. The doors were blocked. People couldn't get out. And, you know, I heard on the local news this morning that as a consequence of that, the police have determined, up until now, the police have been dealing with the whole Occupy movement thing here in D.C., even though there have been a few provocations, you know, going over to the Air and Space Museum and the Newseum and, you know, the guy fighting for the control of the door with a police officer and things like that. But, you know, still, the cops in D.C. are, I mean, they've seen it all. But this morning on the news, they announced that the police department is going to change the way that they're responding to the Occupy D.C. people because the movement has become violent. This is going to be very interesting to watch how this plays out. Meanwhile, in Chicago, a group of senior citizens, again, you know, renegades, you know, the people, and I say that not as a slur, but as a compliment, a group of senior citizens made a human chain and blocked a road to protest what the Gang of 12 might be doing, which is cutting benefits, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, which these people had paid into their whole entire lives. And for which, by the way, there are some fairly simple solutions. Social Security is solvent. It's going to be solvent for another 25 to 27 years. And after that, it's 80% solvent forever. You want to make it solvent forever right now? Just do away with the cap on people who make more than $250,000. Right now, if you make more than $250,000, you don't pay any Social Security taxes. How right is that? And with Medicare, all you have to do is say, you know, we're going to do away with the $600 billion subsidy for the pharmaceutical industry. That says that when Walmart buys drugs for their pharmacies, they get to negotiate wholesale prices. When Walgreens buys drugs, when CVS buys drugs, when the Veterans Administration, the federal government, buys drugs, they negotiate discounts. When the Department of Defense buys drugs from the pharmaceutical companies. They negotiate discounts. But Medicare? No, they have to pay full retail. These poison pills, the Postal Service, the poison pill put in, this is all put in during the Bush administration. 75 years worth of health care benefits have to be fully funded within 10 years. Or we're going to shut down the post office. Come on. Can't you see what's going on? This is not just a corrupt Republican Party and a bunch of rich folks basically squeezing every nickel that they can get out of America and trashing the middle class and trashing small D democracy. It's not just the corruption of Scalia and Thomas on the Supreme Court. It's not just, these are all symptoms of something much larger, which is empire in decline, empire in decay, empire in collapse. The country, in many ways, we have become a pastiche of ourselves, a cartoon character of ourselves. And then you've got, you know, the Koch brothers and these other groups out there, you know, fueling this story. So how do we respond to this? What do we do? Morris Berman actually left the country. He said, screw it, I'm going to Mexico. And I said, you know, Mexico's run by 36 families. You think it's not corrupt? Oh, no, it's far more corrupt than the United States. But at least there's a sense of local community. Well, I found that, you know, Louise, I found that in small town Vermont. There's lots of local community all over the United States, if that's what you're looking for. But they're not an empire.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, some of your thoughts on this, some more of my thoughts on this, other things in the news as well, and a crazy alert. Hey, find a new eternal resting place because you're being evicted. Welcome back to your media support group for We the People, the Tom Hartman Program, and, oh, it's our Twilight Zone alert. Find a new eternal resting place. A Spanish cemetery is threatening to evict thousands of people in their supposedly final resting places, claiming that their leases are up, and their caretakers and relatives need to cough up to pay up. For some reason, many Spanish cemeteries no longer allow people to buy grave sites. Instead, they offer leases up to 49 years, which falls well short of the intended move-out date, usually considered to be an eternity. Already the remains of 420 people have been dug up for failure to pay rent, but the backlash is now underway. Occupants of the graveyard have formed their own afterlife political party. They're calling it the Cemetery Rent is Too Damn High Party. Expect a low voter turnout. Yeah. Okay. Oh, man. The Australian Parliament, by the way, I just want to get a couple of real quick things in here and then pick up your calls here. Australia yesterday passed what they call an history. They use A-N because they don't pronounce the H. An historic law. The things you learn when you do talk radio, right? Australia's Parliament has passed a historic law to tax carbon emissions. Now, these were the terms. The Green Party said that they would form a coalition with the Labor Party, but only and thus have a majority, a parliamentary majority, and rule the country of Australia after, you know, John Major and the Conservatives and, you know, after their love affair with George W. Bush got kicked out. But they said, we'll only do it if you'll agree to tax carbon. It's been very controversial. The carbon industry is a very, very big industry. The oil, coal, you know, the fossil fuel industry, very big industry in Australia. They've been fighting back like crazy. But this is going into effect July of next year, July 2012. And at first, it's a fixed tax, $23 a ton, and it only hits the top 500 most polluting companies in the country. So, you know, the average person, you know, they're not going to come up and tax what comes out of your chimney in your house kind of thing. And then after July 2015, it turns into a cap and trade system, basically a bargain, you know, a market-based system. as Europe has done. Why aren't we with this program? I mean, I learned about this morning because of a relatively obscure post by Al Gore on his blog. So I certainly didn't read it in the New York Times. Maybe it's there, but anyway, I think this is a big deal, actually. Other countries that don't aspire to be empire, that say, you know, we're just going to be us. We're just going to take care of ourselves. We'll be fine. Australia has a national health care system. Everybody's covered. It's cheap to go to college. It's free for many people. And, you know, it's like they're getting by. You look at Sweden, for example, where they so regulated their banks. They were never even there was a time when they were part of the raiding empires back in the early dark ages, the 400s, 500s, 600s. And, you know, now they're just, hey, you know, here we are. And they regulated their banks to the point that when the banksters went down internationally, it didn't affect them at all. So, anyhow, your thoughts on this. Mike in Washington State says you want to disagree with me, so you go to the front of the line. What's up? Mike?
Oh.
You are on the air, sir.
Okay. I really respect your program. It's one of the best on the radio.
But I
respectfully disagree mm-hmm. as to the premise that the U.S. empire is crumbling. And furthermore, I'd like to interject that it is just the opposite. It is still in a growth state.
I think as a nation, our best days may well be ahead of us. But I think as an empire, whenever a nation makes the decision to become a worldwide empire, to control, I mean, you know, we've got, you know, hundreds of military, 700 military bases all around the world. When a nation makes the decision to try to control the world or to take the resources of the world, that they have then, they've made the decision like a cell makes when it says it's going to reproduce on an unlimited basis. It is a cancerous decision, and eventually it must come to an end. And we made that decision some time back. It's hard to identify exactly when. I think, frankly, you could argue that decision was made in the battles between Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson during the George Washington administration. But without, you know, splitting hair, or other people would say that decision was made, you know, when President Polk started the Spanish-American War, which Abraham Lincoln so objected to because he didn't want America to be an empire, or, you know, in the 1830s, or you could say, or the 1840s, whatever that was. And or you could say that decision was made in the late 1890s. When President McKinley started the Spanish-American War and the newspaper publisher, William Randolph Hearst, said to Frederick Remington, who was down in Cuba, he said, "You get me the pictures, I'll get you the war." Frederick Remington got him the pictures. Hearst publicized it and gave McKinley the Spanish-American War, you know, which kind of made the reputation of Teddy Roosevelt, and on it goes, you know. And you say that was when it began, or you know, Woodrow Wilson inventing public relations to get us into World War I. I'm not sure where that point is. I'm not enough of a scholar of the history of empire. But I know that that's where we're at right now. And I know that China is growing like crazy, trying to be the next empire. They think this century is going to be their century to be the empire. And what I'm saying is, it's time for us to get out of the empire business and start attending to ourselves at home. We're, you know, why are we rebuilding schools in Iraq and Afghanistan? I mean, why did we blow them up in the first place? Why are we rebuilding them when our own schools are falling apart?
Well,
your
I
turn.
Agree to part of that, but the difference is today the empire building is not by a singular nation. Because no matter where the United States is exerting its forces, other economic interests in other nations, primarily it's an economic empire, they are also partaking of the growth in their power and by usurping the economics of the world, actually.
Right. So you'd say that the locus, the center, the core of this empire that we're calling the American Empire is actually a group of transnational corporations that happen to be based here and are using the American military to defend their actions around the world, to defend their shipping lanes around the world, and frankly, as their largest customer for many of them.
Yes, to a great extent, though the economic interest, we can't say they are just located here.
No.
And even because we got Asia with three huge growing deep. China, Japan, and Korea, with Indonesia starting to kick in. And the only real focus that the empire builders have left, Latin America is at a hold right now. They know what it's like to get the U.S. down. There's too many examples of that.
Yeah.
But Africa is where our emphasis is, and we have, I don't know. The last I figured out was over 21 different military liaisons going on in African countries.
Right. Yeah, we just started AFRICOM. We just started a U.S. Central Command in Africa, like, last year. And we also
we set up a former one where the old one had been located in Germany before.
Okay. But, I mean, you know, we broke one off. We also broke one off for North America, which we didn't have before.
We broke one off, right. Yes. And what I see more on is people forget all the other countries above Afghanistan. Those are being consolidated.
Right. And so are you suggesting that we are... I'm not sure I get your point, Mike. Are you suggesting that we are not an empire, or that we are not an empire that is crumbling, or that there's nothing wrong with being an empire? I mean, you know, what's... I'm not sure I get your point.
I don't believe in this empire. I am so... In tune to what I've gone to three of the occupation deals in Washington and Oregon, I believe they're going to fail. And this idea of a crumbling empire is only part, instills more fear in the American populace than any invasion by a terrorist when you look at the overall effects it has on the mental attitudes of that population.
See, I think if you, it depends on how you position it. If you say, okay, our empire is crumbling, we're screwed. I would not disagree with you. On the other hand, if you say, you know, it's really silly that we have 700 military bases around the world, that we're trying to control the world, that we're invading Iraq to get their oil when we could have just bought it from them. And you know, let's bring these things home. Let's bring this military home. Let's take this money and use it to rebuild our schools. Let's have America become self-sufficient. And let's have these transnational corporations that are the agents of empire. Let's rein them in. Let's break them up. Let's use the Sherman Antitrust Act. You know, then I think that there's actually something that you could sell to the American people that they would buy, that they would be very enthusiastic about. And Mike, thank you for sharing your thoughts with us. It's much appreciated. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, 866-987-THOM. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. It runs 24/7. Welcome back to the True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program. And our new book out, by the way, The Tom Hartman Reader, we will be giving away a copy through at the end of the program. We'll make an announcement. And for your participation on our message boards or blogs over at TomHartman.com. And the question on the table, and it's really a very large one, I think, is, you know, the Occupy movements, the Tea Party movements, the anti-war movements, the destruction of the middle class, the massive aggregation of wealth, are all of these symptoms, and the pushback against all of them, are all of these, in various ways, pro, con, whatever, are these signs of an empire in decay? And if so, what do we do about it? Bill in Michigan. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Yeah, good morning, good afternoon. I was just going to comment that I've been talking. I'm an ex Air Force cab driver from the Vietnam War,
mm-hmm.
And I was, you know, we were talking, and most of these people are dependent that we could probably get rid of about two-thirds to three-quarters of our nukes because, in the first place, who are we aiming them at? The Russians, the Chinese, the pigeons, the Martians? Well, I mean, what?
Right now it's the pigeons, but I think that what's happening is that the next Cold War is going to be with the Chinese. And it's going to be 5 to 10 years down the road you're going to see the beginning of it.
Okay, but the other question we had, too, was, what do we do about all of our guys overseas? Now we could save trillions of dollars by bringing them home, in except where they're really needed. But, you know, how many of these places really need our guys there except for economic gain, you know, for the money that our guys spend in their
And that's the thing. You know, our rationale is, well, we're protecting shipping lanes. Well, then, you know, let the corporations pay for that, right? You know, let them hire Blackwater.
Exactly.
I mean,
do something for it.
Yeah, and then add it to the cost of the oil. I mean, you know, the Danes are no idiots. They you know, gasoline's $10 a gallon there because they say, you know, about a buck of that cost is goes into our healthcare system because auto exhaust produces cancer, and you know, about a buck of that cost goes, you know, for our national defense and the cost of getting it here, and you know, all these other things. I mean, there are costs associated with these things. If you actually took the cost, I mean, look at this giant coal fly ash thing that just leaked into Lake Michigan. How incredibly toxic this stuff is. If we actually paid, if the electric power industry actually paid the genuine cost of burning coal, if they paid for the cancers, if they paid for the asthmas, if they paid for assuming that autism has something to do with mercury in the environment, if they paid the cost, there's a whole variety of neurological diseases, actually. If they paid for the cleanup of just the mercury, getting the mercury out of our food supply and out of our water, if they paid for the disposal of the fly ash, if they paid for any of those things, all of a sudden the price of electricity would double and solar energy would be a bargain. It would be an absolute screaming bargain. And with regard to our nuclear missiles, you're absolutely right. It's like, you know, I don't think we need to get rid of two-thirds of them. I think we ought to get rid of all of them and just say, hey, you know, we're not going to play that game anymore. Costa Rica has no military. They haven't had an army in 30 years. Does that mean that, you know, their next door neighbors going to say, okay, well, here we come? No. And if you want to have a military, you know, Switzerland doesn't have a military either, at least not a formal standing army. They've never been invaded. Like hundreds of years, they've never been invaded. That was the model that Jefferson and many of the founders wanted to model this country after, and it was the original draft of the Second Amendment, which is that we shall not have a standing army, but every man between the ages of 17 and 47 will have access to and know how to use the military armaments, which will be kept in an armory and will be under the supervision of local authorities. So you have what's called a militia, citizen's militia. Jake in L.A. Hey, Jake.
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I have 2 points. First off, I just wanted to check in. A while back, maybe during the 2004 campaign, Bill Brown had a big issue called justsixbucks.org.
Bill who?
And it was a big push. Bill Bradley.
Okay, great.
Former senator of New Jersey.
Yeah, and former presidential candidate.
It was called justsixbucks.org. And the whole push was just, you know, public financing of elections. And they had this website up. And, you know, so I think, you know, in one regard, that's a big issue that is on the table for the Occupy Wall Street movement that, you know, seems to be ignored right now.
Mm-hmm.
As far as getting, you know, the transnationals out of our government.
Yeah, the problem is the Supreme Court's made that almost impossible. That's the problem. I mean, no matter how much money we raise by, you know, if every taxpayer, you know, there's about 115 million Americans who file a tax return. If all 115 million of them put $10 every year into a fund, that's $1.15 billion a year. So, you know, that's almost $5 billion over the course of a 4-year presidential cycle. More than enough to pay for everything, including shoveling enormous amounts of money at television stations for advertising, which they just absolutely love. And still, the Koch brothers would figure out a way to outspend it.
Well, I mean, obviously we have to work on repealing Citizens United, otherwise that doesn't stand.
Yeah, that's the problem.
Second comment I had, you know, I'm going through business school right now, so you know, there's this huge shareholder, stakeholder, you know, moral dilemma as far as, you know, instructing the future leaders on how to organize their, you know, their companies. I'm personally more of the stakeholder view, but something that struck me was just how, you know, these transnationals are essentially somehow lobbying the U.S. government or whatever to invade these third world countries solely for the purpose of capturing, you know, cheaper inputs into their production cycles, either be it resources or labor.
That's
so,
correct.
You know, we bear the cost to capture these resources for them. Then they sweep in once it's been stabilized, and they convince us to keep a base, keep it stable, so that they can continue to capture, you know, these cheaper costs, you know, this low-cost structure.
Yeah, or in the case of something like Germany, you know, keep a military base here because, you know, you still have to buy military hardware, and you still have to buy, you know, training and blah-de-blah-de-blah-de-blah. And on it goes. It's like, yeah. And it's time for us to say, you know, no thanks. We don't need to be an empire. We don't need to have these wars. We don't need to have these bases. It's you know, Ron Paul is right on this. He's wrong on many things. But on pot and on the military, he's right. And it's just, it's time for America to wake up to this. We're right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Over the last hour, we've been musing on the idea of America as dynasty. Last night we had Morris Berman with his new book on As Our Greatest Mind. You can see that over at TomHartman.com. And, you know, his premise, and it's basically been the premise of three of his books now over the last half a decade or thereabouts, maybe a little more, has been that America is in a decline. It's just, you know, falling apart. So, and because we've been trying to play empire. And the next group that's going to play empire is China. And there have been all these other empires, the Soviet Empire, the British Empire, the French Empire. You know, basically, empire doesn't work. Empire is like the empire is the cancer stage of politics. The way that laissez-faire is the cancer stage of economics. And ironically, the solution to the problems of empire that are being promoted by the right wingers and the, you know, Koch brother toadies and people paid by the Koch brothers or funded by the Koch brothers, whether it's the Cato Institute or the Reason Foundation or the Heritage Foundation, I fill in the blank, is neoliberalism, is laissez-faire economics. It's crazy. Meanwhile, a fourth woman has come forward to say that Herman Cain tried literally to screw her. His brothers by a different mother.
This may be a breaking news announcement for the media. I am the Koch brothers' brother from another mother.
Yeah, so the Koch brothers, his brothers by another mother, are continuing their efforts to economically screw the American middle class. But are we going to see Politicus Interruptus? I mean, elections are set for today in Ohio to determine the fate of this radical anti-union law known as SB 5. Republican Governor John Kasich and his buddies are doing anything they can to stop repeal of that law that he has lusted over. Other laws that, you know, in Maine, the Republicans want to stop early voting and stop same-day registration and all kinds of things. So, yeah, on Friday, Ohio Republicans prematurely ended early voting to keep people away from the polls. The Ohio Secretary of State, John Husted, who has also a cozy relationship, shall we say, with ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, another Koch-funded group, ordered the polling stations to be closed, despite the fact that early voting in Ohio has always been available to the public in previous elections. But this election is different, thanks to a new law passed by Republicans in that state legislature that conveniently took effect last week and bars early voting more than 3 days before an election. As we all know, and Jacob, cue up Paul Weyrich, as we all know, this latest effort is to cut off people from the polls, and it is just the tip of right-wing voter suppression efforts around the country. This is Paul Weyrich, the Republican strategist who made the Ronald Reagan direct mail campaign, which back in that day was the equivalent of doing the internet campaigns today, and who Reagan credited with getting him elected in 1980, and who worked as recently, he died last year, but as recently he worked on George W. Bush's 2000 campaign. Paul Wehrick, Republican strategist, talking to a group of radicalized Christian Republicans about how to basically take over things. Here he is.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome, good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
So you get it? By the way, we have a quote for the day, but my quote for the day is from Barry Goldwater. He said, mark my words. Keep in mind, that was Paul Wehrick speaking to a group of Republican Christians, evangelical Republicans, Christians. He said, mark my word, if and when these preachers get control of the Republican Party, and they're sure trying to do so, it's going to be a terrible damn problem. Frankly, these people frighten me. Politics and governing demand compromise, but these Christians believe they're acting in the name of God, so they can't and won't compromise. I know. I've tried to deal with them. It was Barry Goldwater, who perhaps had a unique perspective on this, being, you know, one of his parents was Jewish, one was Christian, although he was raised a Christian. But he was like, let's separate church and state. So how might this rejection of democracy in Ohio affect today's vote? And, you know, this is, I think, actually a serious consideration and a legitimate question. In fact, here it is, Bob Fetrakis and Harvey Wasserman wrote over at BuzzFlash, at Truthout, for BuzzFlash at Truthout, this piece about, you know, will the 1% steal Ohio's labor rights referendum? And they point out, though highly sophisticated exit polls showed John Kerry winning in 2004 in the state of Ohio by more than 4%, the official outcome had him losing Ohio's 20 electoral vote and the White House by more than 2%. This is a 6% shift between the exit polls and what Ken Blackwell was saying the vote was. They go on to say, by all credible estimates, such a shift of more than 6% was a statistical impossibility. It was primarily engineered by Bush consigliere Karl Rove and Republican Secretary of State J. Kenneth Blackwell. Rove and Blackwell helped knock 500,000 or more, primarily Democratic voters, off Ohio's registration rolls prior to Election Day. In 2005, a corporate coalition parallel to the one fighting to crush workers' rights this year, Wasserman and Fetrakis, right, worked on a comparable issue in reaction to the theft of the vote in 2004. A popular uprising had designed issue 2 to make it easier for Ohioans to vote early by mail or in person. 2 days before the 2005 vote, the Republican-leaning Columbus Dispatch poll showed that issue 2 was going to pass by 26 points, 59 to 33. That's about what the polls are showing right now. Senate Bill 2 is going to be defeated by. But on November 8th, this is like, you know, 2 days later, ironically the same day as this year's vote, today, Blackwell watched issue 2 defeated, which was, a ballot issue that would have said you can mail in your ballot early. And it was defeated by 63.5%. So the polls showed that 59% of the voters in Ohio wanted it. And yet, somehow magically, the Republican-dominated Ohio machine said after the vote, no, 63% of the people didn't want it. So what the hell's going on here? Well, the pension funds, again, back to Fetrakis and Wasserman, the pension funds that targeted unions contained hundreds of billions of dollars in worker assets And if you could take the fangs out of these unions, it would make those pension funds easy prey for people like John Kasich, who was a former Lehman Brothers Uber vulture who got rich with the sale of over $400 million of junk assets to the teacher's pension before becoming governor. Did you know that? That's what this guy did? He ripped off the teacher's union? So I would submit to you that Occupy Wall Street is a middle class revolution. It's either the last gasp of the middle class, or it's something entirely different, which we'll talk about right after the break. Stick around. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back. What is Occupy Wall Street? How is this going to play out all across the country?
What you gonna do on Judgment Day? Time to run out now. You can't stay.
Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, what we're looking at right now in the disintegration of American empire. And make no mistake about it, the empire part of it is disintegrating. The question is it going to be a controlled disintegration, or is it going to be an implosion? The assault on the middle class, which has not yet completely disintegrated, but if the Koch brothers had their way, if the top 1% has their way, there won't be a middle class. Or there will be a very, very small, very neutered middle class that will be the same as in feudal times. F-E-U-D-A-L times, you know, 400 or 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, where the middle class is basically the local shopkeeper or the local doctor or the local lawyer. In other words, it's a mercantile class. And the largest class of people is the working poor. See, a middle class is actually dangerous to the 1%. And they know it. And they've been talking about this forever. I mean, this goes back to, you can go back to the early Enlightenment thinkers, back to Thomas Hobbes, back to his warnings about what happened if the people actually ran the country, because you can't trust the people. Because where the conservatives are actually right is that when the people are comfortable, when the people have a sense of comfort, when there is a strong middle class, and it is the majority of people in the country, maybe only 51%, or even a large minority, 30, 40%, when it's a large chunk of the population. And keep in mind, when Ronald Reagan came into office, more than half of the working people in this country had either a good union job or the equivalent of it. In other words, they were the middle class. They had health care. They had pensions. They had retirement. Their kids could go to college without enormous amounts of debt. And what happens when you have a strong, healthy, stable middle class like that is they cause trouble. They revolt. You had women saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, we're not going to put up with people like Herman Cain anymore. We want to have some power in the workplace. You had the civil rights movement. You had African Americans and others. You know, other minority groups, Native Americans, Asian Americans, gay Americans. What happens when the middle class is strong and people feel like they can go into the streets, they can speak out, and they're not going to be punished for it? When that middle class is strong, you get them loudly pushing back on government policies. We had an anti-war movement. And William F. Buckley back in the late 50s, early 60s was saying, and Russell Kirk in his book, The Conservative Mind in 1952, 53, was writing about, I think first edition was 51, was writing about how, you know, if this middle class that Franklin Roosevelt is talking about, he wants to create a middle class in America, if this comes into being, it's going to destabilize the country. And it did. You had hippies and yippies and women burning bras and African Americans rioting in the streets and gay people in Stonewall in San Francisco saying enough, or was that in the village? Whatever. Right across the board, you had people who had traditionally been oppressed, who had traditionally sat down, shut up, and kept out of the way. Now they were empowered because they were part of the middle class. And they were saying, I want part of this middle class dream. I want the whole thing. I want to be a full member of society. Because Franklin Roosevelt, in the early 1930s, said, we're going to have a new social contract in America. And that new social contract is that everybody is part of this. And in 1981, when Ronald Reagan became president, he said, we're going to break that contract. We're going to end that contract. Because conservatives understand that if they represent only the 1%, they cannot retain their power in the presence of that social contract. The top 1%, the rate at which from 1940 to 1981, the rate during those that period of time when we had that social contract, the Roosevelt administration, the Truman administration, the Eisenhower administration, the Kennedy administration, the Johnson administration, the Nixon administration, the Ford administration, the Carter administration, during that period of time when that social contract was in place, the rate of the growth of wealth and income of the top 1% in the United States was at or slightly below the rate of the growth of wealth and income of average Americans. And so their boy Ronnie Reagan came in, their General Electric spokesman, and he said, that's it. We're tearing up the contract. We're going to go full tilt boogie with deregulation. We're going to stop enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act. We're going to start most favored nation status for company for other countries that we trade with so that there won't be tariffs so transnational corporations can make a fortune. We're going to take the top tax rate on rich people and drop it from 74% down to 28%. We're going to kick off a war on the labor unions and just devastate them. We're going to cut apart the social safety net. We're going to undo the Great Society. We're going to end welfare as we know it. And the result here now, 32 years later, is that, or 30 years later, 31 years later, is that the American dream, the middle class, is not available to everyone anymore. The middle class has shrunk. We are becoming a feudal society, F-E-U-D-A-L, where you've got a small 1% who own pretty much everything. You've got a small middle class that are doing okay. And then you've got a very large class of the working poor. And Occupy Wall Street has created a fork in the road to feudalism. Either it's going to fizzle out and Reagan's America is going to continue down the road to feudalism, or...
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Or we will take a different fork in the road and there will be a rebirth of the American middle class and we will stop playing games of empire. Be right back. Talk media for the rest of us. Tom Hartman here with you. Our cheesy news alert. This is our Borowitz report from Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com, showing the resiliency that has frustrated foes throughout his storied career. Silvio Berlusconi today stepped down as Italian prime minister and assumed the helm of the National Restaurant Association. Mr. Berlusconi told reporters, this is a dream job for me. As he settled into his new offices in Washington, D.C., he said, I love working with people, and I intend to be very hands-on. Mr. Berlusconi won the coveted position after beating out several rivals, including former International Monetary Fund chief Dominique Strauss-Kahn. Mr. Strauss-Kahn said, I must admit I am envious of Silvio. There isn't a red-blooded man alive who wouldn't want to run the National Restaurant Association. But even as he settled into his new post, Mr. Berlusconi served notice that there were going to be big changes ahead for the trade association. He said, I've taken a look at the employees, and they're way too old. Okay. Yeah, Silvio. Herman Cain, now this fourth woman has come out, and you know, but that, I don't think that's the thing. I mean, as I've said all along, he never really was running for president. I've said it before, I'll say it again. He was never running for president. He was running to jack up his speaking fees because he's an inspirational speaker and to sell books. And probably to get a gig on Fox News. And this may kill a gig on Fox News, but maybe not. Because, I mean, just consider this. Clip number 7 here, Jacob. This, you'll recall, back, those of you old enough to remember, in the Clinton White House, Bill Clinton had an advisor who was his right-hand man, a very, very trusted advisor, by the name of Dick Morris. And Dick Morris had this special affection for hiring prostitutes and sucking on their toes. And he made the mistake of hiring one and writing a personal check to pay her, and which she took to the press and told the story about the toe sucking, and he immediately got fired from the White House. And ever since then, he's been disgraced? No. Done away with? No. He's been on GOP TV, which is what Roger Ailes called it when he proposed it to Richard Nixon in 72. We call it Fox News now. Here, Dick Morris on Fox News.
Well, that's always a possibility that she's not going to sue, so it's not going to be a lawsuit.
I look forward to her spread in Playboy.
That was actually Sean Hannity, and then Dick Morris. Oh, maybe she'll do a spread in Playboy. And this was my encounter with Dick Morris back in 2005, the last time. Maybe he'd been on the program more than once, but this was the last. He hasn't come on since then. Dick Morris is with us. Hey, Dick, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. It's good to be here again.
Sandy Berger told me personally, Dick, that he told Condi Rice when she came into office that his words to her were, look out for Osama bin Laden. He's coming to get you. You need to be paying attention to this. This has to be your number one priority. And she said, okay, thank you very much for that information, and then did nothing.
Did he take the document out of his socks when he told you that?
Come on, Dick. Do you want me to talk about hookers with you? I mean, you know, come on, Dick.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for the interview. Bye-bye.
It's fine with Dick Morris. Yep. I mean, this is what happens. So Dick Morris being snarky about Herman Cain, I don't know. It's but anyhow, that's okay. I think we could officially just set that aside and say end of Herman Cain, Dick Morris news. But you know, but as I said, I think that Herman Cain was not running for president and is not running for president. He's running for a job on Fox News, like Dick Morris has. And you know, if you can survive, you know, Dick Morris, you know, getting thrown out of the White House for buying hookers, the Clinton White House at that, and suddenly becoming a Republican because, hey, it pays really well over at Fox News, then Herman Cain can. But the thing that I think is probably going to hurt him more than anything else is what came out last night, which is that his wife's a Democrat. Nobody's seen his wife so far. And Herman Cain comes out and says, yeah, my wife is a Democrat. So anyhow, enough of the Herman Cain stuff. Like I said, this is a distraction. And, you know, are we an empire? Are we not? Where are we going? What's going on with the United States? How do we, you know, so let's just pick up some of your thoughts on this. Patty in the state of Georgia. Hey, Patty, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. When I call, I'm usually laid back. Today, I am absolutely furious. And it all revolves around this Herman Cain dispute. And I feel like my news programs have been reduced to X-rated programs, followed by the unbelievably disgusting Rush Limbaugh comment on this woman. And what concerns me is, A, I have to take my grandchildren out of the room or hit the mute button really fast, and we're roughly the same age. I'm no prude, but it is our image in the world. How are we reflecting to the world as a moral country? We are a decent people. We are a good people. Everybody out there is not entranced with Herman Cain's distractions.
Yeah. And, Patty, I would submit to you that this and the $73 million obsession with Bill Clinton's activities that led to a pornographic report by Ken Starr, you know, while the prosecution was being led by 5 Republican members of Congress, 4 of whom were having affairs at the time, including Newt Gingrich and Bob Livingston and Bob Barr and one other whose name I forget. But Livingston and Barr at least had the good graces to resign over that. That these are symptoms of this is the bread and circus. I was talking earlier in the last hour. I was talking about how America has become an empire and we are an empire in decline. And the three things that hold up empire are bread, circus, and war. And you know, war to continue to keep the young people employed and quiet and out of the way and off in foreign lands and to bring home booty, to bring home, you know, gold or slaves or in this case oil. And the bread, you know, keep people fed, keep them from starving so that you don't have the bread riots like you had the preceded the French Revolution. And circus, you know, keep them entertained. And the Herman Cain thing is the entertainment, the Bill Clinton distraction, all of these things. This is bread and circus, and it's designed to keep us away from the real issues. You will not find a serious commentator on American television who will say Herman Cain's not running for president. And I don't understand why, because he's not running for president. He has no on-the-ground, staff at all. He doesn't have an organization in Iowa. He doesn't have an organization in South Carolina. He doesn't have offices that you can go to. He doesn't have volunteers. All he's got is this media machine, and he's got the Koch brothers behind him. Mm-hmm. And it's become bizarre, I see it as the circus thing. I'm with you. Thank you very much, Patty, for the call. John in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good.
I was calling to tell you about the Occupy movement here in Santa Cruz and a little bit about what's going on up in Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
The people running the show, you know, trying to make sure, you know, organize marches and whatnot, are being very cautious. I have a bit of a jarhead look, although I'm a, you know, a Santa Cruz native and I've, you know, never served in the military. But I guess, you know, having much less hair than most of the people down there, they're very cautious of me, you know. And there's a system in place at the Occupy Santa Cruz for identifying individuals who are trying to cause violence within the group. Because everyone's really aware that there's a whole bunch of people there trying to conduct nonviolent protest
right.
and voice, you know, our grievances, you
right.
know, as is our right.
Yes.
And there's other individuals. And the new, now I'll just let you know, is, and these people need to know this too, that are doing this. Individuals are now following these people who cause violence. And some of them have actually been followed to military bases. So from the Oakland movement, one individual drove over 200 miles after the violence down there was followed over 200 miles. And I won't say what base he went to because there's lawyers who are looking into this.
Right.
So what I wanted to, and what I wanted
in other words,
to
the
is,
agent provocateurs are among us now.
And if you go to an Occupy movement, you have to get with the people who run the movement because there's hand signals involved and people communicate amongst each other privately, you know, and we're and there's ways to identify people who are provocateurs,
right.
and there are ways to shield them to the outside. When you have a large group of people, you can shield violent people to the outside.
Right.
And
John, there's a second problem to this, or a second step to the problem to this, and that is, and you know, I mean, we saw this here in Washington D.C. With a couple of individuals who, in one of several of the attempts to occupy various buildings, actually physically confronted police. I mean, you know, like grabbing a door out of a, you know, a handle from a police officer and screaming at the police officer. And this wasn't an agent provocateur. This was not,
right.
you know,
no,
a,
I'm not saying-
a, you know, so there are people within the movement who think that the best way to get things done is to get as many microphones and cameras around them as they can get by being outrageous and if not violent, at least forceful.
You know, I considered myself one of those people, Tom, but these people, you know, the longer I've spent with these true activist types, mm-hmm. I consider myself a bit of a radical. You know, I'm one who feels like, you know, violence can't be the sole property of the state.
Right.
And, you know, that's just, that's, you know.
But it has to be. It has to be.
People have schooled me down.
Good. I'm glad to hear that, John. I'm glad to hear that. Because violence has to be the sole property of the violent. And the violent are not the moral, and they're not the, and they're not the basis of any positive movement. John, thank you for the call, and thanks for your good work.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll check in with the Talk Radio News Service in just a moment to find out what's going on in the world in Washington, D.C.
Hey, everybody move, we can make a change from New York to L.A.
Helping you in the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you, and Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, is on the line. I see you are in the White House, Victoria?
Yes, indeed I am.
In the basement?
In the basement, yes.
Okay. Now, you know, there's like 10 floors below you, isn't there, of like super secret stuff?
Super secret, yes.
Yeah,
stuff
yeah.
I'm not supposed to know about.
Subways and all kinds of cool stuff. And
where
then,
they work on the things that they deny.
Yes, exactly. And right above you is the do you know what's directly above you?
Directly above me, I don't know. I'm in the East Wing, so I don't know what's directly above me. Actually, I don't know.
Huh? Is that the residence?
No, that's another floor up. At least one more floor up, maybe two floors up.
But above you?
Oh, yeah, definitely above me, yeah.
So
yeah.
You might be sleeping, you might be underneath where the Lincoln bedroom or... Well, anyhow,
I could be.
So what's going on in the world?
Well, federal investigators said today that they have uncovered gross mismanagement at the Dover Air Force Base mortuary that it cares for America's war dead.
Oh,
after
no.
whistleblowers, three whistleblowers have reported horror stories of lost body parts, shoddy inventory controls, and lax supervision.
Oh, my. Was this the consequence of George Bush going into two wars that they believed would be over in a matter of a couple of weeks and would not bring a lot of casualties back, and then suddenly they're bringing back a lot of bodies and a lot of body parts, and they just weren't ready for it?
That doesn't seem to be, from what I'm seeing here, any evidence of that. There seems to be evidence of lax work and lack of respect for the dead.
Oh, my.
I mean, these are horrendous things, and there is also a disagreement between the investigators. You've got separate investigations by the Air Force Inspector General, the Secretary of the Air Force, and the Office of Special Counsel.
Mm-hmm.
Now, nobody's been fired. Some people have been moved to other jobs. But the Office of Special Counsel disagrees somewhat with the other investigations and basically says that the Air Force's conclusions are insufficient and feels that the Air Force has not really taken sufficient action on any of this.
In other words, they're not kicking enough butt, or they haven't properly evaluated the situation?
Yeah, it's not. They're not kicking enough butt, basically.
Interesting.
It's not doing enough. I mean, we're talking about things like, for example, they lost an ankle. Now, this is important because people are being killed by IEDs.
Right.
So they're coming home mangled. And the job here is to put the pieces back together and to make sure that the right body goes home to the right person.
Right.
And they weren't doing it. So they lose an ankle.
That has to be an awful job. You know?
Awful. Awful. And then the two plastic bags containing body parts found empty. A 4-inch long piece of flesh disappears, never located. Then another case where a Marine killed by a roadside bomb shattered from the waist down, but they family requests he be buried in dress uniform. They couldn't fit him into his uniform or a coffin because the section of his left arm was sticking out, so they sawed off the arm, placed it in a bag in the casket. Now, some technicians at Dover vigorously objected, saying it amounted to mutilation.
Yeah.
But this man called Keel overrode them. He's since been disciplined. Now, the Air Force Inspector General said Keel did the right thing. The OSC said this was inconsistent with the highest standards in the funeral service profession.
Yeah.
Now, subsequently to all this and the actions that have been taken against the three most the main people who are involved in the Air Force, who have all been moved and disciplined, the OSC and the Air Force is saying that the whistleblowers are okay. The OSC is investigating allegations by the three whistleblowers that the Air Force retaliated against them in myriad ways, including an attempt to terminate the employment of one of them.
Amazing.
So, and also, the OSC is concerned that even after the matters were fully investigated by the Air Force delayed notifying the families involved until publication of the OSC report was imminent.
So basically, the civilian White House, Office of Special Counsel, the lawyer for the civilian White House, is saying that the military has been covering their butts on this.
Yes, and you remember that this is also coming on the heels of the gross mismanagement at Arlington Cemetery.
Right, right, which apparently had been going on for some time as well.
Yes.
Okay, what else is going on, Victoria?
Supreme Court had a fascinating case this morning weighing privacy versus GPS bugs.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you've been talking about this, but the question is, do police need a warrant before secretly attaching a GPS to a suspect's car?
Right.
And how much right to privacy do you have in public, and is a GPS different from a beeper, which was the last time they looked at this case, sort of case, in 1983.
And in 83 with the beeper, how did they decide?
In 1983... they decide that generally people have no reasonable expectation of privacy to things they do in public, my understanding is.
Yeah, and so I'm guessing they'll probably decide the same way with regard to the GPS device.
Well, they may decide that way, but it's very complicated because the defense is saying that it involves a seizure because you're putting it on somebody's car without their knowledge, and because they did it for 30 days, 24 hours a day.
But,
and so they saw things that one person following the car could not possibly see.
Yeah, but on the other hand, what about the GPS that's located in your cell phone when you're in the car, or the new generation of cars coming out? I forget which manufacturer it is. I think it's BMW. It's just announced that the next year's model are actually going to be internet. You know, instead of a radio, one of the radio options is going to be G4 or G3 Wi-Fi, and so you can use like Pandora or whatever. You know, you can just get your information off the internet, your radio off the internet. And at that point, of course, it'll be entirely trackable. So that's gonna bring back a whole brand new level of mess on this, it seems.
I think so. There's going to be legislation.
Yes, I suspect so. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And what is the consequence of inequality? What is driving it? And why has the United States become the most unequal society in the world? Right up there with Portugal, the UK, and Singapore. And what is the consequence of that? Anthony Randozzo is with us. He's with the Reason Foundation. Reason.com or Reason.org, and at the Director of Economic Research. Anthony, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
I'm looking, first of all, this article that you wrote, Want More Equality, Support More Capitalism. I've been thinking about starting a baseball team, and or a baseball league, rather. And in my baseball league, whoever pays me the most, since I'm going to make the rules, will get to have 5 strikes at bat, and whoever pays me the least only gets 2 strikes at bat. Whoever pays me the most will have, 9 balls, and the other people will have 2. We can even change the position of the pitcher's mound if they pay enough, and there won't be any umpires. Nobody's going to be overseeing what they're doing. We're going to do away with unnecessary regulations. Do you think that that's baseball?
Well, certainly not Major League Baseball, but as long as the other teams that are joining in your league voluntarily want to join it, I don't really see a problem with it. I don't think that it would take off, but you know, if there are people that wanted to do it, that in a free society, that should be allowed.
But I don't disagree that it should be allowed. I just don't think that it would work. And this is what you're suggesting for our economy, that the rule that if the Koch brothers don't want their you know, downwind pollution, which is causing cancer in some cases and killing people, to be regulated, that, you know, they should be able to buy off some politicians or help them get elected so that they can do away with those unnecessary regulations.
Well, yeah, I don't think that anything that I've written suggests that we should have zero regulation in society. And as a matter of fact, particularly given that I spend a lot of time looking at Wall Street and financial stuff, we absolutely have to have regulation and rules of the road, and there has to be laws particularly that provide consequences for failure, for fraud. Those are absolutely necessary.
Then why would you say that free markets are the real source of economic opportunity? Because what you're describing is not a free market. What you're describing is a regulated market.
No, it's absolutely a free market. You cannot have a free market without the rule of law. I mean, we see this in countries like Albania, where they tried to institute a free market, but there is no sense of rule of law. And what you get is crony capitalism. You get
right.
You get,
and that's what we have right now.
My Italian background. Well, right now, I don't think that we have a very free market. I think that we have a regulatory system that does allow for crony capitalists to come in and take advantage. I think that the Supreme Court
has made it possible. It has said, you know, corporations are people, money is speech, so the wealthy get more speech go ahead.
Another thing is that if there were no rules for those corporations to try and manipulate, there would be no reason for them to give money to those politicians and try to corrupt and drive society.
So you want to do away with the rules?
I think that the fewer rules that there are, the fewer opportunities there are for people to come in and try and manipulate the system.
So we should just say doesn't matter whether, for example. Actually, let's just leave it at that. With that, let me move along.
I think we can go round and round.
We could do dueling examples all day long, and it wouldn't get us anywhere.
Exactly.
You're right. If the wealthy get wealthier, no one has to become a penny poorer. This childish idea that the economy is a zero-sum game might appeal to populist sentiments of the so-called 99%, to the envious nature of some others, or the emotions of many struggling through this terrible economy. But in the end, it doesn't stand up to the most rudimentary inspection. Actually, it does. If you look at the statistics from the Fed, this is from the Fed. In 1978, the top 1% in the ladder took in under 9% of the nation's income, leaving a bit more than 91% for the rest of us. In 2007, the year before the crash, they took in 23.5%, leaving just 76.5% for the rest of the population to split up. You talk about how household incomes have not gone down. But household incomes, the average number of people working in a household, has almost doubled since Ronald Reagan came into office. When you look at individual wages, you're seeing, and when you look at individual wages of the bottom 90%, in other words, you take out the Koch, you know, it's the old joke, you know, the nine guys who make $30,000 a year are all standing at the bar. Bill Gates walks in, all of a sudden, on average, everybody there is worth $30 million or $3 billion or something like that. And if you take out, if you filter out that top 1%, then what you see is that average wages are going down, and they've been going down ever since Reaganomics was instituted. The economic policies that you guys are promoting are devastating the middle class in this country.
Well, so first, just to be clear, that one quote, I don't want to take credit for something that was written by David Harsanyi, who writes a syndicated column that shows up on our website. Although I do agree with a lot of what he said. Here's the thing.
You're right.
You know, one thing that I think should be absolutely clear is that income inequality is not inherently a terrible thing. If all of those people that are on the bottom rung of the ladder have $1 million, and everybody at the top has $1 trillion, and that 1% will have $1 trillion, that is not, and that's a huge wealth gap. But that doesn't necessarily mean that.
But that's not going to happen.
Thing.
That's not going to happen unless we have Weimar Republic type of hyperinflation.
But it's not going to happen, Tom. But it does serve a point to say that inherently wealth, income inequality is not a problem.
No, it serves no point. It's an absurd example.
Can be a problem is what are the causes? Why is there a gap? I'm not so interested in talking about what gap exists other than what the causes of that gap are. If the reason that there's income inequality is because two guys went and they stole all the gold from everybody, that's terrible.
Well, I think what you're saying and what we're agreeing on is that the income inequality is happening because our system's being gamed. And I would say it's being gamed because Ronald Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, which was a powerful regulation, which forced competition by keeping companies relatively small. Jimmy Carter was the last one to enforce that, breaking up AT&T. And because Ronald Reagan dropped taxes on the very rich, and so that, you know, we got all this hot money going in the economy. And every time you see that, but just look, I strongly suggest you check out this website, equalitytrust.org.uk. It's Kate Pickett and Richard Wilkinson's book, The Spirit Level. They've done, you know, 20 years of research on this in countries all over the world. Plus, they took every single state in the United States and they said, okay, which has the greatest inequality and how does that relate to social ills? And the conclusion that they came to is that if we were a more equal society, as in Japan, Sweden, Norway, Finland, Belgium, the Netherlands, Denmark, Germany, Switzerland, Austria, Spain, Canada, or France, if we had those levels of equality rather than the extreme level of inequality that we have right now, murder rates would cut in half. Mental illness would be reduced by 2/3. Obesity would be cut in half. Imprisonment would reduce by 80%. Teen births would reduce by 80%. And levels of trust among people in society would increase by 85%, regardless of how you get to that reduction of inequality. So let's look at the effect of it.
So regardless of how you get to it, in that
whether you get to it by redistribution by taxes,
you can get to all of those benefits by showing up with cops at the doors of everybody that's the wealthy 1% and say, we're going to take 85% of your wealth.
Yes.
And we're going to hand that money around to people.
Yes.
Who didn't otherwise earn it.
Yes.
And they're going to all of a sudden, overnight change.
There is going to be a social safety net. When you look at those countries that do enforce taxes, and yes, taxes are enforced by guys with guns. And when you look at those countries that do enforce taxes on the very, very wealthy, and you know, like in Germany, where millionaires are paying 50, 60, 70% tax rates, and you get German businessmen saying, you know, I don't want to be a rich man in a poor country. And you have a strong social safety net. Everyone has health care. Everyone has a retirement. Yes, you have lower outcomes of poor social outcomes. Absolutely.
Well, I think one of the biggest problems with that is it's a correlation causation trap. We talk all the time in this country about how if you have more people who are homeowners, it's going to come to all these social benefits and social gains. But usually those are just correlated, not causation.
Anthony, this is causation.
Benefits.
This is causation. Trust me.
And I would strongly implore, even looking at
this
that research.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Anthony Rendoza, reason.com is the website. Check it out. And equalitytrust.org, UK. UK. Anthony, I suggest you check it out. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom. It's all about the money.
Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you, 20 minutes past the hour. A lot of folks been on hold for a long time. My apologies. Let's get to it. Tom in Ohio. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Tom from Toledo. How are you doing today?
Good. Good. How are you?
Great. I've been out working on the election here on SB5. This has been a long process. Started early in the spring with many rallies down to Columbus and a lack of even being able to go into our state capital. And our good old governor, do as I say, not as I do, Kasich, standing in the way of the people's rights. Well, today's payback day.
Yeah.
Today's the day when the people are going to get out there and show Mr. Kasich and his Republican friends exactly what the people of the state of Ohio have to say. You know, this is a guy that was elected by 68,000 votes over a damn good governor, and he's come in like he had some kind of massive referendum from the public to change the world.
Yeah. Now,
and
here's,
as you said, the former Lehman Brothers man.
Yeah, and in fact, he's the guy who sold the teachers union $400 million worth of crap from when he was at Lehman Brothers for their pension fund.
Not just the Teamsters. But
teachers,
the,
I said.
But the firemen, but all state employees. It was almost $700 million that our good friend lost in pension funds that he's now blaming on the citizens and the workers of the state of Ohio employees. So.
Amazing, amazing. Now, when Blackwell was the overseeing your elections, You had, this was back in 2005, there was this vote on issue 2. And issue 2 had 63.5% of the support, according to all of the polls and the exit polls and everything. Excuse me, it had 59% of support, 33% opposition. But it lost with 63% of the vote. 63% of the people voted against it, according to Ken Blackwell. Are you concerned that this election will get stolen also?
You know, I don't believe that's going to be the case because they're scared as heck. They'd like to see this thing go away. They bit off more of the apple than they could chew, and there's no way in the world that that's going to be the case here in Ohio. I think it's instructive that they didn't put out their yes for issue two signs until recently, and they associated that with issue three in Ohio, which is to do away with the Health Care Act as passed by the Congress 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. So they when recently they put out these yes on two and yes on three signs, and I think they did themselves a bad move because they're showing that the same people that attacked issue two are the same people that are supporting issue three, and that association I think is going to be very good. They won't have that argument next year that the voters of Ohio turned down the president's health care program. So I think they're afraid. They didn't put their information out in a timely manner. Obviously, we've had, you know, the Koch brothers and people running ads on this thing early. They've actually been out for a while. There was a large discussion about the amount of money that was going to be put in this last week. I have seen very little of that. I see our humble governor sitting around his kitchen table talking about the problems of Ohio, but certainly doesn't have anything to say about, you know, this is the first time we ever had a governor in the state of Ohio in probably the last, I would say, 20 years that didn't give up his income tax information, show what his bonus was from the boys at Lehman Brothers.
Oh, interesting.
When he took all that state money, filtered it through Columbus, and dumped it into the boys in Washington, D.C., and the boys in the stock market.
Yeah, well, he certainly doesn't want people to know that. Tom, you know, good luck on the election today. Good on you for being an activist in Ohio, and you know, tomorrow we'll see how it all shakes out. I wish you the very best.
Can I say one more thing about the fund?
Very quick.
Okay, very quickly. In the spring, I had given a large donation, and I suggested that I would be willing to do another one to sponsor individuals and students that don't have the ability to, you know, pay a $10 fee while they're trying to do everything they could do.
Right.
We ought to really take a strong look at broadening our base and people like myself that'd be willing to sponsor individuals. It's kind of a matching grant.
That's an excellent suggestion. I would suggest that you call Free Speech TV or go to freespeech.org and talk with them about that. Tom, thank you very much for the call and for your good heart. I don't know how to say it beyond that. It's like, you know, good karma there. Susan in Gig Harbor, Washington. Hey, Susan.
Hi, Tom. I'm the medical advocate. I'm actually in the firm lands of Juana, but you had a hard time pronouncing it last time. They're already starting the ugly, dirty mudslinging. I got a call the other day that left a number after the 9 p.m. number because it came in from the D.C. time at like 7:48, so technically it was after hours. If they're calling my house at 7:48, they had already missed it by an hour and 49 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
But that number was 1202-600, and then it was 2098. But they basically say it's obviously Republican slanted. They want Obama out now, and I'm not certain if it's Mitt Romney or Rick Perry, because they gave me a web address, but having a VAD unit in me, that's my veins now.
Mm-hmm.
It's having DirecTV built in.
Yeah.
It's because when I took the drug Remicade, it ate out my veins in 2 years.
Ouch. Ouch, ouch, ouch. So
yeah, my lovely, again, I mean, the greed is on every level. You can't even go to your doctor.
Yeah.
That doctor making $10,000 each time he got each of his patients willing to submit ourselves to another course of infusing Remicade.
Yeah.
And made even more when he double-dosed me, because then he got asked by Synthicor to write the survivor of Remicade, because by then I had taken it for like almost 4 years.
Susan, without going, you know, deeper into your personal details, we're out of time here. The bottom line message you wanted to share with our viewers, listeners, is:
and make you believe absurdities make you commit atrocities.
Okay, thank you very much. Well said, and thank you for calling. We'll be back. It's 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Do you agree with the Reason Foundation and their sponsors, Koch Brothers and others, that America's economy is not a zero-sum game?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
In other words, if the rich steal lots and lots and lots, it doesn't hurt the rest of us? I disagree. Good, bad, and the ugly up next. And your calls. Yep, that would be the good, the bad, and the very, very supinavalently ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for the brain. The good. Faribault Woolen Mills. The wool factory in Minnesota has been a community staple since the 1800s. Employing local workers and shipping American-made wool blankets and other products all around the world. That was until 2009 when the factory went under, and the company and all its machinery was slated to be sold and offshored to Pakistan. That's when two cousins, Chuck and Paul Moody, stepped in at the last minute, bought the company, and reopened again in Faribault, Minnesota, and put many of the men and women in the community right back to work at the factory. Currently, the company has 35 employees, but expects to be up to 50 by the end of the year. As Paul Moody said, people are a little tired of hearing, we can't do it. We can do it. We're going to do it here. And I hope that message can hopefully carry over to other industries and get back to manufacturing here in the U.S. Well said. Time to bring back American manufacturing. Anybody here need a blanket? Get in touch with them. The bad. Suffolk County, New York. Jumping on the austerity bandwagon, Suffolk County is making some tough budget cuts. In particular, one budget cut that's sure to leave children and an old war veteran in Suffolk County disappointed. The county has decided to save $600 by doing away with Santa Claus this year. That means that 83-year-old World War II veteran David McKell, who's donned the Santa outfit in Suffolk County over the last 10 years, is out of a job. So if GOP TV, a.k.a. Fox so-called News, is looking for ground zero in the war on Christmas, they better send a satellite truck to Suffolk County as soon as possible. And the very, very ugly Greg Gutfeld. The rising star over at GOP TV explained to Fox viewers what the difference is between the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street. Gutfeld said, the Tea Party are, in a sense, makers. Occupy Wall Street are takers. Here we go again with Fox so-called News' makers versus takers argument, pitting Americans against Americans. Language taken right out of Ayn Rand's books, by the way. But considering the Tea Party takes their orders from millionaires, takes free bus rides to Tea Party rallies, takes all the free swag at Tea Party conventions sponsored by corporations, and takes all the free publicity from GOP TV, Fox so-called News. Meanwhile, Occupy Wall Street has to, from the beginning and continues, to make everything themselves, from campsites to media attention to even general consensus. Given all that, I think Gutfeld has his makers versus takers distinction upside down. And that's very, very ugly. 866-97-THOM, our telephone number, and Alan in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Alan, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you today?
I'm great, but I'll get better, Alan. What's on your mind?
I was commenting on your decline of the American empire. I do believe it is in decline, as was the Roman Empire, but at least Roman's tomatoes will last.
Alan, I'm sorry, your phone sounds like you're underwater. I'm going to have to drop the call because it's gone. I think you were making a parallel between us and the Roman Empire. I'm not sure exactly what it was. Jarrett in Washington State. Jarrett, what's up?
It's Jarrett.
Oh, Jarrett.
The comment that I'd like to make is something that you talked about earlier today, and thank you for bringing up Australia and the new law that they just passed with their carbon emissions taxing. One of the things that I find pretty concerning right now is that we're subsidizing fossil fuels here.
Yeah. Jared, I'm going to have to put you on hold. Your phone is doing the same thing that the last guy's phone did, and I just want to make sure it's not our phones. Let me just put you on hold and try somebody from a different phone bank. Bob in Illinois. Hey, Bob.
Hey, Tom.
Okay, your phone sounds fine. Okay, so what's up?
Yeah, I'm calling about earlier you were talking about the evangelical guy, and I guess I just have this thought about why evangelicals and religions in general and politics go so well together, because they have a common goal, which is to get people to follow, believe, and support them, and when that happens, they have money and power.
Right.
And it seems they go hand in hand. Is it any wonder that the Conservative Party is interested in you know, this is a tool they use to get people to follow along with them. And generally speaking, people like this are looking for something. So it's not a surprise to me that
I agree with you, Bob. And to the extent that some organized religions are basically run like cults, and some politicians are basically, corrupt toadies for whoever are giving them money in exchange for the power that they have. Yeah, I'm totally with you. And that's why we need more politicians like Bernie Sanders. And by the way, Bernie.org is his website, who are just people driven, period. And it's just, anyway, enough of that rant. Let's go back to, let's see if, Jarrett, can we hear you now?
Can you hear me, Tom?
No, your phone is still breaking up, Jarrett. I'm sorry. I try calling back on a different phone. Randy in Arizona. Hey, Randy, what's up?
Down on education.
Randy?
Yeah.
Hey, you're on the air.
Randy
is listening to his radio and not his phone. John, I don't have a city for you. I see the 575 area code. Where are you calling from?
Las Cruces, New Mexico, Tom.
Okay, great. So what's up?
Southern New Mexico. You got to watch you on Free Speech TV because you're not on the radio yet. You should get on that, by the way.
Okay.
Hey, Tom, I was listening to Anthony Rendozo, and I just want to ask you, I noticed that the very last point he made, he asked you that rhetorical question about redistribution of wealth.
Yes.
But he wasn't even interested in your answer. You kept telling him yes.
Yes, I know. I know. They're operating on the assumption that guys with guns showing up to take part of the money that you earned, which is the libertarian definition of tax collectors, that is such a horrific thing that everybody will be horrified. And I believe that taxes are the cost of entry to a civil society, and that there will be some people among us who will break the law. That they should be enforced by the force of law. There will be some people who will break the law. And, you know, I mean, you could say, you know, guys with guns are going to prevent you from jaywalking, too. I mean, there's a whole spectrum of, you know, things that, or guys with guns are going to prevent you from murdering people, or guys with guns are, you know, fill in the blanks. I think that paying taxes is an obligation that we have to, you know, to pay our share of the cost of society. And if people want to take the benefits of society and not pay, I don't have a problem with there being penalties, with guys with guns showing up and taking them into court, and if they can refuse to participate, putting them in jail.
Well, if I could say one more comment, the only thing I'd say is I listen to these guys. I hear them ask the rhetorical question. He just talks right over you as you're answering him. And what I was thinking is this guy needs to have a conversation with Chris Hedges or somebody. You know, he's a magical thinker, and which means – it's kind of like the you talk about the web of debt. These people think that they've earned all this money, and that everybody else can just disappear for it. But society doesn't work like that, as you point out all the time.
Yeah,
you got to pay your dues. You know, they drive down these roads. I don't know what they're to me, it's magical thinking.
Yeah, it is. It's the Ayn Rand cult.
They just don't want to participate anymore.
It's the Ayn Rand cult. These, you know, the Reason Foundation is you know, about objectivism and libertarianism, which came out of Ayn Rand's, you know, worshiping Edward Wayne Hickman, I think his name was, the murderer who lived without society's rules restraining him. And you know, she's, although Ayn Rand in her final days when she was dying of cancer did take Medicare and Social Security, she basically, until she needed it, she asserted that anybody who did so was a taker, not a maker, a leech. it's just, I think it's tragic. But, John, an excellent observation. Thank you very much for calling and making it. Robert in North Carolina. Hey, Robert, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, glad to hear from you. Hey, you know, I know you talk with Senator Sanders all the time, and I think like many people out there, I view him as America's senator. So a couple of us over on Google Plus were kicking around an idea. Why don't we get Senator Sanders to lead a panel to get candidates for all of us to vote for out in our elections coming up so that we can clean house? Because, you know, all of this talk about that we hear from Occupy Wall Street, from my local Occupy Raleigh folks, to translate it into political action, we're going to have to attack the ballot box. And I see Bernie as a uniting force that could bring us all together to start making the change that we need to make. And wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Well, you know, I don't talk to Bernie much except on the air. I mean, for 7 years, I think every Friday he's been on our program for an hour. But we're not like, I mean, you know, I know him as a result of that, and I've met him personally a few times. But it's not like, you know, we get together for drinks every week kind of thing. And but I do know that he is of the opinion that, I mean, he's got, that he's the senator from Vermont. He's representing Vermont. That's a full-time job. That's what he's doing. He did start the Progressive Caucus in the House of Representatives. He was in the House of Representatives for, I think, 18 years, the longest serving independent in the history of the House of Representatives since the founding of the Republic. And now he's in the Senate. And that Progressive Caucus is doing some really great work with its 80-plus members, I believe. And there's some progressives in the Senate, and he started the Save Social Security Caucus. And so, you know, he has been trying to pull together these folks. But I think he's going to have a real challenge. I mean, he's up for re-election next year, which is why I suggest people go to Bernie.org and help him out, because he's going to have a big challenge. I mean, last time, 6 years ago, he had a guy come in and spend $5 million on the campaign and say things like, you know, Bernie supports child molesters and stuff. I mean, it was just, it was incredible. The attacks on Bernie, that's because Bernie had voted against some bill that had something about that attached to it. So I doubt he would be up for that, but you should call in the program and ask him.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Occupy the Cokes. Occupy the Courts. I got to tell you about the Occupy the Courts after this.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Cynthia, is it Wolken, Cynthia?
Yes, yes.
Cynthia Wolken is a city councilwoman in Missoula, Montana, and the point person for MoveToAmend.org in Missoula. And is today voting day, Cynthia?
Yep, it's when they count all of the mail-in ballots.
Okay, great. So today is, and can people also, you know, drive up and vote today?
No, we have an all mail-in ballot, so you got to turn your ballot into the election grounds or to your local school or show up to the fairgrounds.
Okay, but you can do that today as well?
Yep.
Okay, good. Okay, so the polls are still open, so if you're listening in Missoula, Montana, and you haven't gotten your ballot in, get it in now! So
yes.
MoveToAmend.org. Tell us about what it is that we are talking about people can vote on in Missoula.
Right, well, basically, we wanted to give... Sure. Yeah. We had a bunch of constituents that were concerned about the Citizens United case and the effects of, you know, money in politics. And, you know, we have some corporations at the state level that are suing to invalidate some of our campaign finance restrictions in Montana in the mm-hmm. wake of Citizens United. And so we at the city really wanted to give our constituents an opportunity to have their say on the issue. I think a lot of times local governments are in a lot of ways the purest form of democracy we have left.
Yep.
And so we wanted to give our citizens a say and take that to the state. Hopefully it will pass, and take it to our state and federal elected officials and say, hey, look, you guys need to fix this.
Yeah. Okay. That's absolutely great. And this is a resolution saying to your federally elected representatives, I'm assuming?
Yep, and our state elected.
And your state elected to please push for an amendment to the Constitution to say corporations are not people and money is not speech.
Right.
Right. God bless you. You're doing good work. Cynthia Walken, thank you so much for coming and sharing with us. MoveToAmend.org is the website. You can create one of these in your own community, too. You can do what Cynthia has done. And I'm just real quickly curious, Cynthia, how did you get involved with this?
Well, I actually had some citizens actually come and talk to me about it and say, you know, what can we do? Mm-hmm. So really it was pretty grassroots, and then there is a lot of support. The nationwide movement building has really been incredible. So it's a grassroots, but, you know, with the support of other communities and some of the national folks that are working on it.
So people watching or listening right now should contact their, should go to their city council person and say,
Absolutely. Hey,
you know, why don't you do like Cynthia did in Missoula, Montana, and put a resolution on the ballot so that, and this is more educational than anything else, but it's also pressure,
right.
to say corporations are not people, money is not speech, let's amend the Constitution to make that clear. I mean, the Constitution never said that, but the Supreme Court has over the years said that it says that. And, you know, we need to fix that hole in the 14th Amendment where it says persons rather than natural persons. And this is the way to do it. Cynthia, thank you for the great work that you're doing and for sharing
with
us.
Thank you so much.
It's great to hear from you. I honor your work as a city council person, which is extraordinary. I mean, just being willing to step up for an elective position anywhere in America is a big deal. And your participation with Move to Amend as well. Thank you again.
Great. Thank you.
Great having you on. So anyway, this is interesting. Is that Armin in Florida? Armin, I think you've already called this week. Randy in Arizona. Hey, Randy, what's up?
Stuff, you know, long gloves.
Randy? No, okay. Randy in Seattle. Let's try a different Randy. Oh, Randy, I think that line must be bad because it always sounds underwater. We're going to have to reboot it when we get off the air. Jeff in California. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hello.
Hey, Jeff.
Yeah. Yes. I will.
Your phone is breaking up, too. I think we may have a problem with our phones here. I'm going to try and take a couple more calls and see if, you know, we need to reboot our system. Andy in California. Hey, Andy.
Hi, Tom. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, you're coming through just fine. Either there's an epidemic of bad cell phones out there, or we've got to reboot our system as soon as we get off the air. But anyhow, what's up?
Yeah, well, I've been a Green for 30 years, and I'm now running for Congress registered Democratic.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm doing it because of basically my experience 30 years as a climate crisis organizer.
Mm-hmm.
And when you assess how we have to make our climate change, there are four different areas where we can pursue it, and I've ruled out three of them. And they are personal lifestyle changes. We've been working on that for 41 years, and it's not done it.
Since Rachel Carson.
A lot of great governors and mayors who have come together trying to do what Bush wouldn't do, but their projected decrease in emissions is about one-third of what's needed.
Yep.
And then we have these international treaties, which Bush, Obama, whoever you want to put in power, they're not going to approve it. So that leaves the Supreme Court and Congress. Obviously, the Supreme Court's out because the president determines who that is. And so we're developing a method here in Humboldt County on the north coast of California, which is a unique district, heavily Democratic, whereby we organize year after year to get 40,000 votes. That's all we have to do here to win the Democratic primary. And since we're gerrymandered Democratic, that gets us the election.
Wow.
So I've actually built a campaign around your book. I have everything from rebooting the American dream in my 100 issue positions and a campaign called New Green America, which is seven proposals. Fight the climate crisis is threat number one. Rebuild America's infrastructure around bioregions and sustainability to meet all our needs as close to home as possible. Tax the rich, Medicare for all, an expansion of the social safety net. Retreat the U.S. empire, end corporate personhood, legalize marijuana and the war on drugs. Prosecute Bush for war crimes and electoral reform and paper ballots.
That's great.
And
Andy,
so like
Andy, I wish you the very best. Do you have a website you want to plug it?
Yep. My name is Andy Caffrey, CAFFREY, and it's CaffreyForCongress.org.
Caffrey, CAFFREY for Congress.org. Thank you, Andy, for calling in. And I think it is our phones that are dying. My apologies. Coming up tomorrow, the latest on the Ohio election, Politicus Interruptus. We'll talk with National Progressive PR strategist Cliff Schechter. Plus all the other news of the day and issues and your calls. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up, when you participate. Tag, you're it. Get out there, get active, occupy something. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.